Welcome to Relationships 2.0 with author and clinical psychologist, Michelle Skeen. Michelle and her guests will endeavor to guide you through the pathways for self-understanding that'll help you create and maintain safe and healthy relationships. You can find Michelle on the internet at michelleskeen.com. Now the host of Relationships 2.0, Michelle Skeen.
So one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on again is because, well, actually there are several reasons. Every time I have you on my radio show, I hear from people who say, I love Arthur, I want Arthur to be my therapist, and so I'm meeting the needs of the listeners and also my own needs. I love chatting with you, and you are always full of such wisdom, and you dispense it so well. So here we are at the start of a new year, and also another a new presidency.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's been troubling me that...
Thank you for the compliment, by the way.
Oh, you're welcome. There's more where that came from. One of the things that's been troubling me is just how divided people still seem to be, even post-election. And I'm concerned that this kind of... Well, I guess I'm worried about a couple of things. One, I think, and we've discussed this before, but I think character is a really big... is really important that we all, you know, identify our values, live our values, be mindful of our, what kind of, how we're behaving and how we treat people, and that we are constantly aspiring to be the best versions, the best version of ourselves. And my concern is there's so much, I think, bad behavior that has come out as a result of, you know, the election process, and that it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you're constantly exposed to a particular kind of behavior, you might first identify as being, oh, this is unacceptable, but over time it becomes more acceptable because you just become accustomed to it. And I'm wondering how we can keep, I want to be mindful of keeping myself in check while witnessing behavior that seems to be widely used.
Yeah, I mean, those are great points, and we can have a great discussion about that. Because we're not on air now, are we?
Yes.
We are? I'm sorry, listeners. I thought Michelle was just sharing with me her private thoughts.
No, this is like one of our conversations that we would have.
Okay, so we're on right now. Okay, so we're talking to the world. I got it.
You're being bugged.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, these are concerns that I have, and I was thinking, you know, before we got on the phone, that about 90% of the people I see in a week, which is a fair number, and you know I have three ongoing groups, I would say that about 90% of the people are anxious about what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very prevalent. And I think we have witnessed very bad behavior among leaders. And I think it is really concerning to many people because so many thought that this kind of behavior in several instances would not be tolerated in the United States. We would not have leaders like this. They would be more sophisticated, more compassionate, more empathic, and kinder. And we're not seeing that. And it has many people very concerned. And I'm not talking about a political persuasion. I'm an independent.
Right.
I voted for Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, I vote based on the personality and the perspective of the individual. But I think we're seeing a lot of very trite, insecure behavior, and I think we're seeing a lot of vindictive behavior, which is not really what a good leader should exemplify. I mean, a good leader should not be motivated by status or image, but should have a natural interest in teasing out the potential of all people. And leaders like that lead with great passion, and they're very motivated by doing service. And their egos are on the side. They're not primarily driven or offended so easily as we're seeing currently.
Right.
And I think that way of being, that we cannot tolerate criticism. I mean, look, Saturday Night Live and other shows have made fun of every president and vice president since they've been on the air. That's what they do.
Right.
Celebrities make comments about political figures. That's what they do. We have much larger issues to address in our world than having it, what I think Buddhists call small mind versus large mind.
Right.
And I think we're seeing a lot of small mind behavior, which has got people very concerned, and it's extremely poor modeling for our young people. Extremely poor modeling.
I agree. I also feel like there are probably a lot of people who feel very marginalized, and that we will end up feeling more disconnected from each other rather than more connected.
Well, it's interesting. I think that's happening, but I also, a parallel process that I see happening is, like Bernie Sanders said last week, he said we fell asleep. He said Americans fell asleep. And what I see is that Americans are waking up in both parties and independents. I hear from people that they want to be much more involved.
Mm-hmm.
People want to get involved. They're paying attention. They want to get involved in local politics. They want to speak out more instead of being silent in the face of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than being in a conversation where they know someone is being prejudicial and just tolerating it, but they're more apt to say something now. And I think it's brought out a lot of that in people, that you cannot sit on the sideline and expect our government and our communities to function in a compassionate way. You have to be involved. We have to be proactive.
Right. Well, I mean, if the net result is that people are getting more involved and engaging more, then I think that's really terrific. And I suspect that one of the reasons that Trump got elected was because there were a lot of people who felt like they weren't being heard.
Yes.
And he was a megaphone for that. I mean, he does. There is also, I think there's this little bit of perverse pleasure that we all get when we see someone acting out, you know, that we wouldn't want to do it. Like, maybe we would be too nervous to do it, or maybe we don't want to suffer the consequences of it, but you see someone else doing it and you take a little bit of delight in it because they're possibly saying what you would want to say if you didn't have to edit yourself. They're possibly, or maybe they're just saying it in a way that you wish you had the freedom to do. Are you getting a sense of that at all?
Yes, I think in the beginning, and I think you're making a very important point, that Trump and some others were saying things that people only think. And I think people were tired of being so careful. You know, how many times we hear people talking about the PC issue has gone too far, that we can't really talk honestly and openly with each other. And I think, of course, we could. But I think people were tired of Congress saying the right thing and not doing anything or much in the service of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, political political leaders like Donald Trump come about when there's great dissatisfaction in a country, and we've seen that historically in many countries. And what you know, there was a tremendous dissatisfaction with Congress before the primaries, before there were 15 people running for office in the Republican Party. That it was before that. People lost trust. All the polls and studies showed that people lost trust. Trust was lower. Empathy was lower. Mm-hmm. Narcissism was higher, and prejudice was higher in our country before the primaries. So the time was right for someone to come along and kind of be a free spirit. Of course, he carried it to an extreme. But another factor, I think, that was taking place is people didn't take Donald Trump seriously. They thought it was a joke. And he got a lot of attention by being loud and being aggressive and by being insulting.
Mm-hmm.
And he threw people off their game. Someone said to me yesterday in one of my groups, he said, how come Marco Rubio spoke so intelligently the other day, but he couldn't do it in the primaries? I think aggressive people and aggressive insulting people can get under people's skin. And I think that's what happened with a number of people. When he started calling Marco Rubio Little Marco,
right,
you could see that had an effect on him.
Sure.
And it threw him off of what he was trying to present. And then he started insulting Trump and on, and a number of others did the same thing.
Right.
That's what happens when people don't really know how to deal with a bully or a narcissist or someone who's very good at insulting others.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're vulnerable in certain areas. And then you lose your focus. I mean, we see it in the corporate world all the time. When we have aggressive corporate, somewhat sadistic leaders, they destroy the spirit of people below them, but people are also very afraid of them.
Right. You know, it's interesting you're talking about Rubio, and then, of course, the same thing. I mean, Trump ended up kind of taking Ted Cruz down in the same way, didn't he?
Yes. And he said horrible things. I mean, he said things about his wife that weren't true. He tried to bring Ted Cruz's father involved in the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
I mean, he would say anything to dismantle another person's integrity and their stature. And it worked. Unfortunately, it worked. But as many people thought for a very long time, and that's where I think we did fall asleep, it didn't seem like this could possibly be. When the videos came out about it, the way he talked sexually, look, 52 NFL current players signed a petition saying they had never heard that language in a locker room, and they've been in locker rooms all their lives, and they still are.
Right.
I was an athlete. I was in locker rooms all through college. I never heard people talk like that. Never. And people didn't think you could possibly gain approval and do things like that. But it happened. But I think what we're talking about, the foundation for it happening, was laid way before this.
I think that one of the things... first of all, I wanted to mention that before my daughter went back to school, we watched a 2011 Comedy Central roast of Donald Trump. And I don't know if you've seen any of these Comedy Central roasts, but they're pretty funny depending upon who is being roasted. And back in 2011, he was threatening to run for president in 2012. And so it was very surreal to watch it because they were all roasting him for if he was president of the United States, and here he is, which... you know, is amazing, but it was very interesting to watch him. There were some pretty awful things said to him, and I think that, you know, he handled it pretty well and said that, you know, everyone was asking him, why would you do this? And he said that, you know, all of this money goes to charity, and that's why he did it. And I mean, ultimately, as we're watching this, I'm thinking he has the last laugh. He actually won.
Yeah.
And I want to be clear in terms of this conversation, because I know that, you know, email I get from listeners, there are people of both parties who listen to this show, and I am not saying anything against how effective Trump might be as president of the United States. I don't have any idea. What I'm trying to do with this conversation with you and is to help us maybe understand how we can come together and get along when there's been this huge divide created, I think. And also to just acknowledge without saying, I'm not saying Trump is a bad person. I'm saying there's some bad behavior here. And I worry about the contagion of that, right? So no longer is it, wow, now a president of the United States can just, well, like the tweeting, for example, that, and yet at the same time, I understand that this is how we make progress as a nation, as a world, as a species, is by engaging in new behaviors or new ways of being. And if it wasn't that it feels to me like there might be an erosion of character and values and what is largely determined to be a proper way of behaving, I wouldn't be having this discussion.
Yes, yes. You know, I think what you and I agree upon, I mean, our careers have been based on trying to tease out the potential in human beings to help them be happy and lead balanced lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we're focusing on is far more and deeper than just political issues and political perspectives. We're talking about, you know, when you are so vulnerable and insecure that you can't tolerate criticism from anyone and you have to strike back in a vengeful way, there's an uncomfortableness within yourself. It's recognizing that power and prestige and status, you have to look beyond that. I mean, that's what empathy does. It allows us, empathy is an assessment tool. It allows us to look in a deeper view into the heart and soul of another person and see, even if a person is beautiful or they have power or they're a CEO or they're a CFO, it doesn't mean that they have happiness. It doesn't mean they have connections with other people of depth. And what contributes to that? Well, how do you do that? Because ultimately, no matter what status we have, if we fail at love and connections, we fail in life. So one of the learnings here psychologically is this kind of behavior doesn't make a person happy. Bullies aren't happy inside. Bullies don't live a balanced life. People who insult other people don't live a balanced life. And they're constantly in tension within. Unfortunately, some people, when they have unresolved conflicts, they work them out internally. Or often, you know, they're more apt to criticize themselves. Other people project it out and they spray it around. It's always somebody else's fault. And when you do that, when you're a blamer, which I think is one of the worst characteristics of any personality, you can't change because your fate is always in someone else's hands. They have to change their behavior,
right?
Not you changing your behavior. So a lot of what we're seeing is a lesson for us to decide what. Don't you want to be happy? Everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to feel deep connections to other human beings. How do you do that? What kind of character, what is the character that leads to that and sustains that? If you're that affected by comments that people make, it means there's something unresolved in you. It means there's something you have to go back and look at. You know, people often ask me, how much do we have to talk about the past? And I say, you only have to talk about the past if it interferes with the present.
Right.
If it interferes with the way you're relating right now, look behind you, not in front of you.
Right. And also, I mean, in terms of the past, I think it always impacts perspective. So it is important to at least acknowledge the way in which it's distorting your lens on the present.
Yes. Yes.
And it often does. But if we bring it to awareness, then we can say, oh, that's why I'm experiencing this particular event in this way.
Yes. We have to realize when we're placing old faces on new faces.
Yeah.
You know, because when we react, when we're quick reactors, when we react very quickly to what people say,
yeah,
and we don't react thoughtfully, it's usually history. I mean, you know that.
And yeah.
It's what we try to teach people. That's your history pushing you to react.
Right. And the fast thinking versus the slow thinking.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And it makes your world very small.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what small-minded behavior is about. We have to go back and understand the hurts that we experienced so that we don't keep re-experiencing them the rest of our lives. I mean, so many people go to their graves that way.
Right.
With that, trying to work out what they really don't see clearly because they think it's in front of them rather than behind them. And, you know, neither you or I are fans of belaboring the past, but if it interferes, again, it has to be dealt with.
Right. Absolutely. You know, one of the things I was thinking about, too, is that this is really an opportunity for all of us to open up and have a broader perspective on the, or at least our country and our, you know, the fellow citizens of our country. I think that with this election, one of the things that we saw is that it's really easy. You and I are on the coasts, and that, you know, people on the coasts are really guilty of ignoring what is popularly referred to as flyover country. And I think that everyone should have an equal voice. Everyone needs to be heard, and this is basically what happened.
Yes, yes. Yes, I mean, I'm in favor, and I think what you're saying is, I believe every American gets one vote. I don't care where you are. And I think that the Electoral College, I mean, and I know we don't want to go too far into political theories here, but it doesn't make sense to me. It really doesn't. I know it made sense many years ago because of the distribution of power in the country, but I think it's outdated. And I think in any election that we have in anything that I know of, the person who gets the most votes wins, period.
Yeah. It is interesting that you have people who live in certain states who feel like their vote doesn't count because of the Electoral College.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So it's like, well, this is like California. California is always going to go blue. And you'll see pockets of red, but I think that there are a lot of people, and then there are red states where it wouldn't matter. Again, if you were voting for a Democrat, it might not, or it could leave you with the feeling that your vote doesn't count.
Yes, and I think when you get characterized as a red state or a blue state, it encourages people to not be involved to some extent.
Right.
Like, I know people in Massachusetts, because it's a Democratic state, they automatically assume, well, you know, Hillary will get the electoral votes here, so, you know, I didn't really vote. But if the popular vote was important, if you knew that the popular vote was going to indicate who's elected, that would have been perceived somewhat differently.
Yeah. I think it is important for us to take individual responsibility for our actions. So I think it's really one of the things I'm thinking a lot about is it's really easy for both camps to have a bias about the other camp. Actually, this even happened in our family. My daughter was telling me, I think it was before it was post-election. She was telling me that some of her girlfriends and some of their moms were going to be coming to Washington, D.C. to participate in the Women's March on Washington. And I said, my daughter and I are really close, or so I thought. And I said, oh, that sounds like fun. And one of her girlfriends, and who, you know, I'm close to, and her mom was going to be there too, and I said, oh, how come you didn't invite me? And she said, oh, I just didn't think you'd be interested in that type of thing. And in fact, the truth is, I'm not much of a marcher. I'm more of a runner. But what became, you know, I thought about it, and I realized that what was really important to me was that, first of all, I not get trapped in this mindset of, oh, this is what people who, you know, who are, or this is what these types of people do, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever that is, whatever that means. And also that I want to have an open mind. I want to embrace opportunities to expand my way of thinking about something and to connect with people who I might not otherwise connect with. Mm-hmm. And so I'm actually going to be doing the women's with my daughter and a group of her friends and a friend of mine from New York, the Women's March on Washington. And I'm really excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the open dialogue between you and your daughter, and I know you're very close and connected, and I know how much you love her, and I'm sure she loves you very much as well, that allowed you to correct a misperception and join her, because she thought you wouldn't be interested. In fact, at this time in your life, you are interested. Maybe you're not interested in going and marching.
Right.
Many times, but she, you know, you have an openness and not a defensiveness, so you could gain more understanding of what you really want to do. So you're going to do it together, which is great. But if you were very you know, touchy with each other, if you were very defensive with each other, that wouldn't have happened.
Well, she had. I won't say who said this to her, but she did have someone say to her, well, obviously, this is just going to be an anti-Trump protest. There's no way that any women are going to be there who voted for Trump, and this is just this, you know, liberal form of protesting his inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see why some people are going to have that belief. And the only way to dispel the belief is to get involved.
Yes.
And to put faces, individual faces, to this experience.
Yes.
And sure, are there women who are upset with some of the things that he said about women? Sure. Should they be? Sure.
Yes.
Doesn't matter who the man is. That's not moving us forward.
No, and, you know, as you know, liberals can be as rigid as conservatives, because when you identify with one extreme and you negate everything else on the other side, you don't have open eyes, you have closed eyes, you have blinders on. So either extreme can be very rigid and denying of other people's perspectives. But one of the things I was thinking of as we're talking, because you asked earlier, you know, how come this came about, and I was thinking of the concept of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And people I know really came to believe that there is no authenticity or genuineness in Congress. You know, I have a client who's been a lobbyist in D.C. for many, many years. She's in her 70s. In fact, she just retired. And she was telling me, she said, you know, you can go to breakfast with a congressman in the morning, and they'll tell you what their view is. And she said, you know, they all know me. I've been around for a long time. And she said, once the polls come in, and each one of them has pollsters in their own state, once the polls come in, that same afternoon, they can say the exact opposite thing on air.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know what their constituents want to hear. And she said it's so different now than it was 30 years ago. She said 30 years ago, like Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill would debate till 2 o'clock in the morning, and yet they were very close friends.
Right.
And you know, Tip O'Neill, when Nancy Reagan told a story to Katie Couric once, not long ago actually, before her death, that when Ronald Reagan was shot, Tip O'Neill was the first one in the hospital in intensive care. And he held Ronald Reagan's hand, and he knelt down and said, "Mr. President, I love you." And she said, and they used to argue till 2 o'clock in the morning. I used to have to come downstairs and tell them to go to bed. But they respected each other, and Katie Couric asked her why, and she said, because they genuinely believed that what they were doing and what they were trying to institute was in the best service of the country.
Mm-hmm. And so how do we get that? I mean, I guess it's one of the things is, first of all, recognizing that each of us can make a difference, and it's really easy to feel like you... I'm just one person, I can't make a difference, but there's some expression that all you have to do is think of how much damage one mosquito can do, you know, to recognize that all it takes is one. But we need to individually recognize our power and the transformative quality that we all ability that we all possess to treat each other well and behave in ways that express our values and our character.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, that would be the ideal. I think what's happened in our country over time is that we're so driven by materialism and appearance that we're trying to live up to images rather than being our genuine self and even discovering our genuine self.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many people come into therapy or come into some of my leadership groups and they talk about, well, I want to find out what's wrong and correct it. And, you know, I find that really what we're doing is we're uncovering what's been right about the person all along that's been covered over by certain ideas they have of what's going to make them lovable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've become so appearance and material driven that, I mean, my clients from other countries they're just astounded about how obsessed we are about how we look and how we speak and you know, and how impressed we are by status. They constantly refer my clients from other countries about when they watch the news here. Like, they can't believe when they watch the news there's so much talk about celebrities in the morning. And so little do we hear about what's going on internationally. And
right.
they're just very surprised by it. We're accustomed to it. You know, if something happens with a celebrity, that could dominate the first 5 minutes of the news.
Right.
Or maybe the last 5 minutes, the first 10 minutes. And when we're living up to an image, then we have to love like we're an image. And what happens then? We have to pretend, and we don't even realize it. And when we're pretending, we don't really connect. And we don't really feel love because we know we're not really revealing who we are.
Right.
And I think in a larger context, that's what happened with Congress. People don't believe when they hear a senator speak that it's authentic. They don't believe that it's genuine. They believe they're just positioning themselves to maintain themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the studies at Michigan State and I think and some other universities about how when people rise up the economic ladder, they tend to become more greedy, less ethical, and they tend to cheat more. And about 10% of the people, their character doesn't change, but as people rise up the ladder, and, you know, when you're in Congress, you make a lot of money. You can make a lot of money speaking. And I'm not saying every single person is like that. But Americans, I know, have lost faith in the authenticity of the people that represent us. And then they're our models, and celebrities are our models. And when we don't look beyond the surface of these people, we can really believe that what we see on the outside is what we need to be.
Yeah.
And then we're caught in this inauthentic circle, which leads nowhere and leads to stress, tension, and unhappiness.
And let's talk about that stress. You know, anyone who's been listening knows that your book, The Stress Solution, tackles a lot of these issues that we're discussing, and I think that I love that you're talking again about how the lack of authenticity and presenting as this kind of false self or identifying with things that are about other people that are more superficial and that don't have anything to do with character or values incredibly stressful and what it does to us.
Yes, and I think, you know, because stress, it's not a mental disorder. I mean, most people who are stressed are not on medications and they're not necessarily in therapy, but they don't even realize the negative effects that it's causing, that when you release the stress hormone cortisol, it has so many negative effects if you're releasing it on a daily basis. I mean, weight gain, inflammation, hair loss, breaks down muscle tissue, flabbiness, depression,
right.
Kills neurons in the memory center of the brain, and on and on and on. But it's sort of like when you live with a low-level temperature, you don't even know you have it until you don't have it. And it causes
right.
so many physiological changes, but also it makes us poor partners. It makes us not ready for love because we're not calm enough and present enough to be in love. You know, we become poor listeners because we're so agitated about, you know, the next thing we have to do, the to-do list. You know, I often ask people how their weekend what has been when they come in on a Monday, and you can tell when people say, I got a lot done. And, you know, I always say to people, you know, when I'm in the casket, I'm going to have a to-do list in my pocket because I'm never going to get it all done.
Right.
And what I'd like to hear when I ask somebody about their weekend is that they enjoyed it. They were happy. Maybe they were with family or friends, or they made a new friend. But you don't hear as much about relational connections. You hear more about what was achieved.
Right.
What was accomplished.
Yes.
And I think people don't realize what that's doing to their brains and their overall health.
Absolutely. I think that it feels like we're climbing this, there isn't a top to this, a summit to this action, this mountain that we keep climbing, and it's exhausting and it's stressful
yeah.
because you see no end in sight. It's difficult to stay motivated, and it can feel overwhelming, and it can. What I'm seeing a lot with people is I'm seeing people withdrawing a lot. I'm seeing, rather than, you know, when they're stressed, they're anxious, they're upset, rather than reaching out and connecting like we are now and, you know, producing oxytocin, they're withdrawing and they're isolating.
Yes, yes.
As a way to, and I get it. I mean, I need to do that to refuel sometimes, but I also recognize that I need the balance. And even if I might not be feeling it at the time, that I need, that means, that signals to me that I need to make an extra effort. Okay, let me reach out to my friends, let me set some things up for the weekend, because
yeah.
it would be really easy for me to just stay tucked in.
Yeah.
And one of the things I saw, this was really the first time in a long time, a very difficult holiday season for everyone.
Yeah.
I don't think I really had contact with anyone, whether it was friends, acquaintances, clients, who was having a joyful time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that building the fall and the election, I think, was really stressful for a lot of people. I think
yeah.
I know the news was really stressing me out, and post election, I've been trying to really limit the amount of time that I'm watching the news. I want to be an informed citizen, but at the same time, I don't want it to be just overwhelming or creating a lot of stress or impacting my mood negatively.
Yes. Yes.
But I saw a lot of people who were really, really having a difficult time and unable to, in some ways, really talk about it, because I think that it's such a, you know, politics is just such a prickly subject. So it was difficult for even people who love and care about each other to have
yeah.
discussions about it without it getting heated. So I think a lot of people were just saying, okay, well, we're not going to talk about this. Or
yeah. Well, you know, I had this, a similar experience, Michelle, but what I try to focus on is, I think it's, it, in the end, ultimately, these discussions about politics, you know, in one of my groups, people were kind of arguing with each other, and I said, we're not really talking about politics anymore. We're talking about who we are. Mm-hmm. In one of my marital sessions, one of my clients, the wife, said, I don't think I can live with my husband anymore because, you know, she was voting for Clinton, he was voting for Trump, and she said, I had no idea that he thought the way he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And what the reason is because, you know, when I meet with them, it's very obviously they've never talked to each other about much. You know, everything was about, like, what the kids were doing or what private schools they were going to go
right.
to, when he was going to travel or when she travels, but they really never talk about how they feel about each other, and when I ask them to do that, they're lost. It's like they don't have the words. And this is a case in point because, you know, I'm in my home office. I'm looking around, and I realize all the paperwork I have to do. And I almost sort of had a moment of, I realized I was totally involved in what we're talking about. I had forgot about all of that because we're in an authentic interchange.
Right.
And I'm very interested. I'm interested in the way you think and your insights. And so right now it produced a calm in me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our nervous systems talk to each other. We're changing our neurochemistry. And, you know, you mentioned oxytocin. I mean, and I've said this 1,000 times, I know, but it still amazes me. The giving and receiving of empathy, I understand you and you're trying to understand me, produces this feel-good chemical. It's like we can do it through the way, I mean, we're doing it on different coasts through the phone.
Right.
Because of a depth of interacting and understanding. We're not talking about the weather.
Right.
The NFL playoffs. I mean, that'd be fun, but we're talking about something that really matters to us. And the connection deepens, and then it changes your brain. And that's what's missing. That's what's missing in our relationships as a whole, and that's what's been missing in the people who represent us. People, when they listen to senators, they don't feel connected. They feel like it's a PowerPoint presentation.
Well, and one of the things, and we've talked about this previously, and it's an important chapter in your book, The Stress Solution, is prejudice.
Yeah.
And I think that, well, I mean, even looking back on the story I told you about my daughter, obviously my daughter had a prejudice about me that she just thought she's, you know, I'm not even going to mention this to my mom. Like, she didn't even invite me to so that I could say, oh, sweetheart, you're so cute, but you know I don't march. And, in fact, it's one of the things that we address in the book that we co-authored together, Communication Skills for Teens, that has a lot to do with, you know, beliefs, but also the way that we get these fixed ideas about people who are close to us, in, you know, like family members, because, oh, you used to be that way, you probably still are, and yet, especially with, you know, with children and how rapidly they develop and change, there has to be a regular reassessment of kind of who they are and what they care about and what their passions are and that kind of thing. But I think that, you know, as you discuss in your book, prejudice really gets in the way because we don't need to have a discussion. Let's say that you tell me you voted for Clinton and I tell you I voted for Trump. I don't really need to talk to Arthur about Clinton. And you're thinking, I don't really need to talk to Michelle about Trump because we have these fixed ideas about who you are based upon who you voted for.
Yes.
And I don't think that's correct.
Right. You know, someone asked me during the primary, when you hear people are going to vote for Trump, how can you even sit there and listen? And I said, the reason I listen is every time I go into it and really explore it with someone, I get different answers. Oftentimes I'm learning something, not only about politics, but I often am learning more about the person. And it's hardly ever the same reasons. You know, people have a lot of different reasons. What you're saying is if you judge the book by the cover, you don't really read the book, and you don't know much. You know, so you buy a novel because it has a beautiful picture of the ocean, but you don't even know what the contents are. So I've learned by asking people, well, why do you like Clinton? Why do you like Trump? What do you think?
Right, clarification.
Yeah. And helping them and myself assess what are the facts. Like people, well, Clinton did such and such. I said, well, where did you hear that? Well, my cousin Joey in New Jersey, he works in a cube, you know, and the cube next to him, the fellow is really reads a lot. Okay, well, what's the fellow? The fellow who is next to Joey in the cube, who's your cousin in New Jersey, told you that? Well, what's the source of that? Oh, I don't know. It was on the internet. Where on the internet?
Right.
You know, so once you start doing that with people, they realize I'm saying something like it's a fact, and I don't really know that. I don't even know the source of it. I'm just trusting something that I heard over the water cooler.
Right.
And we shouldn't make determinations about any human being that way.
Right. So, you know, there's been a, you know, discussion and a number of articles I've read lately about cognitive bias, and now because we access so much of our news on the internet and, you know, this rise of fake news stories and everything, I don't know that I still understand it, but that anyone can have a website with news stories and all of this. And then also, if we have a bias about something, then we're going to look for the headlines of news stories to confirm that bias.
Yes.
And not for things to disconfirm it. And also, our attention spans are much shorter now.
Yes.
So
yes.
Long, you know, we're not going to read long articles maybe like we used to. There's so much to be distracted by. And I have to say that I think for most people, it is that it's very triggering of a fear response. You know, what's true and what should we believe? And if you feel like everyone's lying.
Yes. Yeah.
And it started to feel like that it started to kind of come down to it during the campaign. Who's a bigger liar?
Yes. Yes.
Who lies less, you know? And who really cares about us?
But I think if we learn from that, it teaches us to focus on the facts. And I mean, that's why I emphasize empathy so much, because empathy is an assessment tool to find out the facts, and don't rush to judgment. Slow down and,
well, cognitive empathy.
Yeah, when you're using your mind to assess, well, I heard it on one of the shows this morning, but what does that mean? Is it true? Vitamin C cures this? Or, you know, we hear all kinds of things that could be corrected the next day. But when we spend some of our time, like people ask me, how do I learn about nutrition? Well, I read the UC Berkeley and Tufts nutrition letters because I trust them. You know, mm-hmm. I've looked at them over time, or you find a few websites that you know are credible. Or there's certain people. When I go buy a car, I call my friend Jimmy because he knows everything about cars. When I buy a car, I end up using my cell phone, and I have him talk to the salesperson because I trust him incredibly, you know, because I know he knows. I might not be buying the car that he likes, but I know he knows cars.
Yeah.
So, you know, same with my plumber and my electrician.
But people need to get to that point. So when we're dealing with people who are new to our world, it can take some time to figure out if you can trust them or not.
That's right. Think of,
so you have this history with these people you're talking about, and I hear you. I have the same kind of history with some people as well, but it really makes it, I think the challenge is being open to new people and new experiences, that we have to go through this period of discovery, and that it might end up being pleasant. We might figure out that, you know, it may result in someone new being in our life who we can trust and who you can have a relationship with. Or it may end up being a bad experience, and you may have opened yourself up to someone who isn't trustworthy.
And if you do, then you'd probably learn from that. I mean, I think of online dating. Some people seem to find someone that they really connect with. Other people, you know, make such poor decisions. They ask, well, how do you do it? And I said, well, I wouldn't, you know, go out with the first person that responds to you. You know, trade some emails, talk on the phone, ask some questions, be open to what you think you're hearing. Try to learn from your biases. Learn from your longings. If you just got divorced last week and you're on Match.com this week, you're probably not going to make great decisions, most likely, because you probably have a longing to connect to someone and you're afraid you won't find someone. But if you slow down the process and maybe you get some help from some people close to you, you can probably make an assessment and maybe you go for lunch with the person. Maybe you schedule a one-hour lunch or 40 minutes and then you say, well, I have an appointment, I have to go. And you know, you take it slow. You try to learn. And when you know how to listen, you learn a lot about people. And some people are so afraid of it. Like we have some people in one of my group, a couple of the women in the groups have gone through divorces, and they wouldn't even think of doing anything like that, where some of the others are on different sites, and they're meeting people, but they're taking their time and kind of assessing. And just like you said, have they made some mistakes? Yeah, but they don't go so far that they're getting devastated by their mistakes.
Right. Yeah, it's challenging and I mean, you mentioned the fear of maybe not meeting someone or fear of being alone. You see that a lot. People can make some poor decisions. So it's, yeah, I think moving slowly and thoughtfully is always really important. I want to go back to something you touched on in terms of listening, which reminds me of, you know, communication and how important it is to, you were talking about this earlier, but just clarifying what people really mean when they say something, or even what, like when you're asking for clarification with some of your clients or friends about why they voted for a particular person. And one of the things that I feel like I've really grown so much and learned so much more by being open to hearing other people's opinions, even when I know that I probably don't agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm only wanting to hear from people who I agree with, my perspective on the world is very limited.
Yeah.
And I'm also saying, oh, I'm so smart, the way I think is the right way, and if anyone disagrees with me, I don't want to hear it because that's the wrong way. Don't waste my time.
Yeah.
And I think that my opinions on things have really changed, and that I'm a lot more gray in my thinking than black and white. And I would say that I definitely went through a period of time when I was younger that, oh my gosh, if you're this way, you're just, you know, you're ridiculous. And
yeah.
Now, I think it's fascinating to hear what people think and what their views are, and I'm happy to explain mine if someone's offended by something that I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it opens up your world. It makes life so much more interesting because you can learn from so many different people who have such different perspectives. And as you said, you don't have to adopt their perspective, but it's very interesting to hear how they came to that point of view or why they find it valuable or even certain activities. I mean, I have friends who love to golf, and they've been trying to get me to golf for 20 years. And I tell them, you know, when I'm in my 80s and I slow down, I'll
right.
golf with them because then I'll feel like it's an aerobic activity. And you know, I have to listen, and I understand now why they love it. I just don't want to walk around that long, you know.
Right.
You
find something else to do with them, and they probably don't want to do your crazy spin class either.
Yes, yeah, yes.
Right? I mean, I have one person who will run with me. No one wants to run with me. No one wants to go running with me. That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine, right? Because you have different likes, you have different dislikes.
Right.
But again, it is amazing how even when I listen to people, like before one of my groups starts, if someone says, like sometimes I'll have, because I get there first, I'll have music on my phone, Pandora, and I'll be, and some, oh, I really don't like her, or they'll, some people will be so careful to make sure they hear what the other person likes first, and then you never really get a sense of what they like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they're so focused on the image piece. I want to be loved. I want to know, you know, I'm other-directed. I want to know what you like first, and then I'll like it too. And it's not quite that simple, but I can see they're paying attention to that. And other people just say it, oh, I had Sia on, for instance, and one of the guys said, oh, all she does is scream, and one of the women said, oh, I love her. And then there were a couple other people, they just stay out of it. You know, they don't want to venture into that for fear that they may be seen a little differently.
Like, right.
Whose side should I be on? One person said they liked her, another person said they didn't. So what do I do? Well, they just stayed out of it. They withdrew.
Right. It's fascinating. Well, I love our discussion so much, and I know we're going to start doing this regularly and tackling issues that, well, I guess just providing a dialogue around how we can continue to connect with each other and create more relationships, deeper relationships, even with what seem like additional obstacles that get thrown in our way.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that, Michelle, to be speaking with you on an ongoing basis and maybe providing together some insights for your listeners that'll make their lives a little happier, a little more balanced.
And if you have any, well, so Dr. Arthur Sierra McCauley, you can find him at
BalanceYourSuccess.com.
Right, BalanceYourSuccess.com, that's what I thought it was. And his latest book is The Stress Solution. And if you have any questions that you would like for us to address in future interviews, you can email me through my website, MichelleSkeen.com. And we'll be back soon with another great chat. I really appreciate you taking time, Arthur, and now you have to go back to your pile of papers.
I think I'd rather keep talking, but hey, you know, we gotta do some things we don't like.
You gotta get some bills sent out, right?
Yeah.
Well, be well.
You too.
Do you panic when you don't receive an immediate response to a text, email, or voicemail? Do you become clingy or demanding when you feel someone pulling away? Do you stay in unhealthy relationships because it's better than being alone? Or do you avoid relationships altogether? If you answer yes to any of these questions, you may struggle with fear of abandonment. This fear can trigger intense feelings of jealousy and anxiety that result in unhelpful behaviors that ultimately sabotage your relationships. Psychologist Michelle Skeen's powerful book, Love Me, Don't Leave Me, will help you develop a new perspective about yourself and others, and you will learn to recognize and change the behaviors that are hurting your relationships. You deserve to have closer, loving, and lasting connections. To find out how, go to www.michelleskeen.com. That's www.michelleskeen.com.
America's wounded warriors are coming home. After serving on foreign shores, these brave men and women are returning to their families and communities. Many have wounds you can see, and many have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. Now that these warriors are back home, they are ready to enter the civilian workforce. To help, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These extraordinary men and women bring proven world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork to the job. And to ensure the right warrior finds the right job, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right match. When you hire a wounded warrior, you hire an intelligent, talented, and committed new employee. Contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.